Hi, everybody. Welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb. I'm Carrie Diamond, editorial director of Cherry Bomb, the indie magazine about women and food. On today's show, we'll be talking with Chef Preeti Mistry of Juhu Beach Club in Oakland and Chef Katie Button from Asheville, North Carolina, who has a brand new cookbook. This season of Radio Cherry Bomb is brought to you by Knopf, publisher of food's most fabulous icons, from Julia Child to Lydia Bastianich, and home to new literary talents such as Sweet Bitter's Stephanie Dantler. Our first guest is Katie, a mom and the chef behind Curate and Night Bell in Asheville. Katie holds a degree in chemical and biomolecular engineering from Cornell University and a master's degree in biomedical engineering from École Centrale in Paris. After volunteering with Habitat for Humanity in Zambia, she decided to drop out of a prestigious PhD program 2 weeks before it started. She wound up waitressing at Jose Andres Mini Bar in Washington, D.C., and began a new chapter of her life. We're going to let her tell you the rest. Katie Button, welcome to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Thank you.
It's great to finally have you here.
I'm so excited.
So take us back to that time in Zambia. What was going through your mind?
Well, I mean, I needed a break. I think I decided I needed a break from the studies and working. I'd been working in a laboratory in Baltimore and just wanted to get out and clear my head before my PhD started. And I wanted to do something great and travel to an interesting place and a culture I'd never been to. So I found the Habitat for Humanity program in Zambia and went and built houses for a month. And it was really an eye-opening experience for me. When I think about it, it changed my outlook a lot because I'm sitting there in this country with these people who really, in my mind, looking at them, I didn't felt like they had very much, at least not very much material things. And we were building their homes because they didn't have like brick and mortar homes. But the children, in the end, I think what changed is I realized that they actually had a lot and it was pure happiness. I mean, the children were just so thrilled with their day-to-day life and playing with a soccer ball and being outside with each other. And, you know, they didn't have iPhones and, you know, video games and things like that. And I don't know, there's just this overwhelming feeling of joy. And I think that I thought, gosh, it's been a really long time since you felt like that. And maybe it has something to do with your career path and what you're doing, and maybe getting back and jumping into a PhD program and committing the rest of your life to something that you're not that you haven't gotten that much love out of.
You had been on a pretty specific path.
Oh yeah, it was like, and I think it was just like a bulldoze ahead, like one thing after the next. Oh, what do you do next? Well, you graduate from Cornell with a degree. You have no idea what you want to do, so you do more school, right? It's like, and you just continue. And I think that's why I was on that PhD path, because I tried to get a couple jobs and I interviewed horribly, because if you're not super passionate about what you're doing, there's like no way you're going to nail an interview.
So you had been in school. So you've got like 12 years, you know, grammar school, high school, then you went to college, then you went to grad school. So you were in school for almost 20 years.
A long, long, long time, which is why I didn't go to culinary school. So I after I kind of made that switch, I got in working as a server because I felt that was a way that I could get my foot in the door and see what I wanted to do in the restaurant industry.
And so why DC and why Jose? Because that was the next thing that changed your life.
So DC, purely because I was there. My PhD program was actually between the NIH and Bethesda, Maryland. So I had an apartment that I'd already like set up and I'd already moved down there when I made all this decision. And I dropped out of the program without telling my parents. I was like, I'm committed and I'm going to do this. And then I'm going to tell them afterwards so they can't, like, I've just burned that bridge forever. And I think I told them like after I'd gotten a job waitressing where he was a server at Cafe Atlantico. And I purely found Jose because I was going through the Zagat guide in DC and just like going to the top restaurants with my resume that had like no restaurant experience whatsoever.
What was on your resume?
A ton of academic experience and like laboratory work. And I'm like, here, I promise I'm going to be awesome. Like, bring me in, let me work in your kitchen. But working in the kitchen, like with absolutely no experience, they were like, I'm sorry, get out of here. So I quickly decided to apply for a server position just to see, get my foot in the door in the industry. And I just knew that from the very beginning that I needed to make my way to the kitchen.
Were you a good server?
I was great. I think so. I really loved it. You know, I love the energy of a restaurant, just that, like, it's like your adrenaline and it's busy and service happens. And it's the same in the kitchen, like the front of the house, the way it functions and that just that energy flow and the way it works is the same.
So for those of our listeners who don't know about Jose and who he is and what he is, want to tell us about the life force that is Jose Andres?
Yeah. So Jose Andres is a Spanish chef here in the U.S. who has, gosh, I can't even count how many restaurants, 14 more, I don't know, now in the U.S., all over. I mean, he's really brought and spread Spanish cuisine all over the United States. And I think he's one of the main people who have really changed Americans' perception and view of Spain and Spanish cuisine. So that is kind of my tie to why I ended up opening a Spanish tapas restaurant and doing a Spanish cookbook is all because it started with him, and that became the food that I was most comfortable cooking.
So how did you talk your way into the kitchen?
So I started first working a couple of days on my days off and like interning in the kitchen at Mini Bar and learning a little bit. And then I went and had the opportunity after meeting chefs and my husband who works at El Bulli to go and work as a server at El Bulli. And, you know, somebody was like, hey, you want to go to Spain with me? And like,
and work in the best restaurant
totally
in the world.
Right. And I was like, yes.
Okay. You have to take it back one step because that's not a normal trajectory for anybody.
I know.
So, tell us about El Bulli also.
Right. So El Bulli was, you know, the best restaurant in the world for 5 years. And it, at the time that I went there, it was its like third year being the best restaurant in the world. And, you know, it's Ferran Adrià, who's the chef, created, he was like the king of creativity. I mean, everything that they did each year was how do we create something that didn't exist before in food. And it's amazing to think about that because we think of food and it comes from so much tradition and history. And here there's somebody who's basing a lot of his food off of tradition and history, but creating something, a technique or a method that is totally different and unique and totally new and doing it over and over and over again. I mean, it blows my mind. So I got to work there in service because working for Jose Andres, I met all the chefs. And El Bulli was only open 6 months out of the year, and then they closed for 6 months. And the chefs and people who worked in the restaurant would go and travel and like work in other places. And a lot of them worked with Jose because Jose had worked at El Bulli. And that was kind of the connection of that family. So as soon as I stepped into Jose's world, Jose Andres's world and his family, you know, it like brought me into that family of El Bulli. And it also happened that the love of my life, Felix Mayana, happened to work in the front of the house at El Bulli for 5 years. And so he says it's all the 5 years that they were number one. So
of course. So you go there as a server. Was this frustrating for you because you kind of knew in the back of your mind that the kitchen was ultimately where you wanted to be?
I think it was amazing. First of all, I didn't know Spanish. And I spoke French, but I didn't know Spanish. I had to learn Spanish because the whole kitchen like spoke Spanish and the whole thing.
I read that on your nights off you would study Rosetta Stone or something.
Yeah, not my nights off in the mornings before I go to work. So we'd like finish at like 2 a.m. and then I'd get up at like, you know, 8 or 9 and like sit with Rosetta Stone because I was so nervous to go in there and have Ferran like tell me some order and me have like no clue. He has a really thick accent too, so it was like a double whammy. But it was great, and I learned a lot. And I think starting in the front of the house gave me a really great global perspective of restaurant operation. Like now I'm not just a chef, but I am owner and operator of two restaurants with my husband and family. And I think that having that global view of both sides in a restaurant, because I also worked in the kitchen at El Bulli, in a restaurant of that caliber and seeing how that the whole system was organized gave me an incredible view for owning, operating, and running my own restaurants.
So when was that seed planted, that the next thing for me, or the eventual thing for me, is my own restaurant?
So that happened probably like right when we were moving to Asheville, which I know seems crazy, but I knew eventually that I would want to run my own restaurant. I think that was as soon as I was working in the kitchen at El Bulli, or even when I was working in the front of the house. I think I was addicted to that to the restaurant industry and the life and the feeling and pleasing people and creating something and watching their reaction, instant gratification, which in the lab I never had. It like takes months to get a result or years. So I love instant gratification. So that was really what drew me in. And then we moved to Asheville to, because my mother was in, had always dreamed to have her own restaurant.
And she was in catering.
Yes, she was in catering when I was growing up. And we moved to Asheville. She wanted to open a restaurant in Asheville, and Felix and I were going to help her do that. And
so your whole family.
Yes.
And your husband-to-be.
Yes.
All decided to move to Asheville, where you'd never lived before.
Right.
To get into the restaurant business.
Totally.
There's nothing strange about that.
Not at all. Asheville, like, I think, is an amazing place and draws people in, and you're just like, I want to live here and I need to figure out how to make that work. So we moved down there to do that. I was born in South Carolina, so it's not too crazy why moving down towards the South, even though I grew up in New Jersey, wasn't too crazy. But when we got there, we started talking about the restaurant, and Felix and I quickly were like just putting more and more and more energy and ideas in it. And my parents were like, hey, let's split this partnership. You know what I mean? Let's all take a piece. Let's all divide it up and let's see what happens. And that's when we created Curate, the Spanish tapas restaurant experience and concept. And Felix and I really ran with it, him with the front of the house and me in the kitchen.
So tell us about the restaurant. You walk in.
So you
walk in.
What's
going on? What do you order?
You walk in. There's like a huge 20-foot marble bar and the kitchen's right behind it, like a long line. As soon as you walk in the door, that's what you see. And guests are sitting at that marble bar, and then there's other guests sitting at tables nearby. And so you're in the same space as the kitchen. There are no walls. There's nothing. It's like a really completely open kitchen. And I think that that's really important because it adds to this energy and dynamic. And, you know, you've got pots and pans clanging and dishes and, you know, we're doing tapas, so it's tons and tons of small plates like rushing out of the kitchen because everybody's ordering a lot of things. So it, I think it makes that whole feeling just really vibrant and fun to be a part of. And then the food is really traditional Spanish food. We try to stay really true to that. I mean, while we're using ingredients that we find and can get, some of them are imported, but a lot of them are in our local Asheville, Blue Ridge Mountain region. And we create Spanish tapas in that area.
So tell us a few highlights.
Sure. So pulpo a la gallega is like a really traditional dish. It's one of my favorites. It's Galician style octopus, and we slow cook the octopus, and then it gets served with Spanish paprika and olive oil and salt and potato. And it's purely about the quality of the octopus and the cooking of it. There's not a whole lot more to it as far as complexity in the dish, but it's melt in your mouth, buttery deliciousness. And then another one is esquechada, which traditionally in Spain is made with salt cod. It's a Catalan dish, and esquechar means to shred. It's usually shredded salt cod, like a cold salad with tomato and black olives and onion. But we serve it with local mountain trout because we have great trout where we are. And we serve the trout. We get the trout the day that it's pulled from the water, and they bring it in, and we slice it up, serve it raw with like a lemon vinaigrette and some fresh tomato and black olive and onion. It's very true to the traditional dish, just doesn't use the salt cod.
So how is Night Bell, your second place, different?
So at Night Bell, we have a lot of liberty and freedom to be creative and really get in touch with the food and the cuisine of our region and Appalachia. So we really are focusing on two things. We're focusing on regional ingredients and cuisine. We're also focusing on food waste. To me, when I think about Appalachia and where the dishes are coming from, that history and culture, it's all about preserving, saving, I mean, cured ham and using the lard to cook with, creating these stews out of dried beans and things and pickles. And it's all about not wasting anything. And so we've really used that model in our restaurant. We get in full four quarters of cows and dry aged, and we butcher them and we use all their little bits and pieces. The tallow we use to make hand pies, and the beef is used for tartare, and our burger that's ground with Benton's bacon and topped with house made pickles and served on a brioche bun that we're making with local grits. And then we serve the steaks and the short ribs, and sometimes we make sausages depending on the quantity of the meat that we get out of it. But
Wait, you make the buns out of local grits?
Would you
mill them into flour?
Yeah, exactly, cornmeal. Okay. So we take the grits and we turn them into cornmeal by grinding them up. And it's got flour and things in it. It's a brioche recipe, but with the cornmeal put in. I love that recipe and how that turned out. Just this like super light, fluffy, buttery bun with the flavor of like cornbread.
So somewhere along the way, you had a little one, Gisella.
Yes.
Right? Am I saying her name right?
Gisella, yes, you did.
And so how are you balancing having a child and having two restaurants and now a cookbook to promote?
So she's 20 months now, and it's definitely challenging. Right now she's with my mother at home, and I'm traveling this week, and it's definitely hard. My days have changed how I structure my week so that when I am in town, I really want to spend time with her. So I try on weekdays to take both Sundays and Mondays off. I'm not always successful, but I really, really am trying hard to take two full days off to spend with her. And then Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, I try to work until 6, and then I want to be home and I want to make dinner and put her to bed and be around. And then Friday and Saturday, I work at night. And that's kind of the schedule that I've set up. I'm not always as successful as I like. Things are popping up, you're kind of on constant call when it's your own business, and that can be challenging, but trying to make my time with her quality when I do have it. So
this just popped in my head. You and Preeti both spoke at our first Jubilee conference, and we had had a panel on how to actually have a family and have a life in food. And I remember it was Gabrielle Hamilton and Suzanne Gowen and Christine Mulkey, and Christine brought her baby on stage. And I remember you telling me that you loved hearing that because you were a little on the fence at that point about whether you could even have kids.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was going to be possible to kind of do both. And then, hearing them speak, and basically the message that I took away with it was like, look, you're going to feel guilty all the time. You're going to feel guilty about not being at your restaurant because your staff needs you, and you're like, gosh, that's your baby in some respects. And then you're going to feel guilty for not being home to put your daughter to bed. And some weeks and some days you spend more time in one side of your life, and then some weeks and you spend more time in the other side of your life. And, it is what it is. And you do that kind of like ebb and flow of where your focus is. And I think that's where it's true, because that's exactly what has happened, just trying to balance it throughout a year, I guess.
So tell us about the cookbook.
So the cookbook is Curate, Authentic Spanish Food from an American Kitchen. And it is the cookbook from the restaurant, but I'd say, 60% of the recipes, I took the restaurant recipes and created them for home portions. They're not tapas recipes. They are family dishes serving 4 to 6 people. I never expect, and nor do I sit down and cook like 8 things for a meal. I think being a mother had me looking at this cookbook really differently, because I'm thinking, gosh, some nights I want to come home and I just want to whip something up out of a whole bunch of things that, like, 4 different things that I have in my pantry or refrigerator, and I want it to be super fast and easy. Other times I want to have friends over and I'm interested in doing a little bit more effort, like braising. So I want to try an interesting new ingredient, like braising rabbit, and in some spices with pimentón and vinegar, and putting a little more effort into it and doing a project. And then sometimes I want just those middle arranged dishes that take a little bit of time, but they become your staples, like the tortilla española, which is a Spanish kind of omelet with eggs and onion and potato, that's turned into my weekly clean out the refrigerator dish. Every Sunday I pretty much whip one up out of like leftover vegetables that I have cooked or whatever I think is like going bad, and just swap out the quantity of potatoes for the amount of vegetable that I have. So I really was focusing on creating a full range of dishes. And there's a bunch of dishes also that I created just for the book. So I'd say 60% were from the restaurant, and then another 40% are recipes that I created with the book in mind.
Who was your team on the book?
So I had a co-writer, Genevieve Coe, and the photographer was Evan Sung. He did an amazing job.
Oh, good team.
Yes. And then my staff, who helped me out, Allegra Grant, Frank Muller, and Nathan Lanham, and my husband, Felix, who did... He's my idea guy. He gives me lots of ideas, and he keeps me honest in the Spanish cuisine. You know, I create something, and he's like, lots of times I nail it, so that's great. It's good for me. He's like, I don't think you've ever had this dish, ajo blanco, like the chilled garlic and almond soup. I'm like, no, I haven't, but you told me about it, and I made it. He's like, it's perfect. So that's always nice.
So what's next for you?
Next for me, we are working on expanding Curate into the building next door. We started construction a few weeks ago, so we're wrapping the bar around the corner and putting in a sherry bar with like vermouth, cider, and sherry on tap, and serving some montaditos, which are little bites and kind of a limited menu section of the restaurant, and putting in some wood fire grills and expanding the kitchen. And I'm just really thrilled and excited because it's going to allow us to do some things like suckling pig and stuff that I've really wanted to do.
Very cool. I haven't been yet, and it breaks my heart because I've been everywhere down south, but not Asheville.
You need to come. I know. You all over downtown, down in the south. So
I will get there, I promise. And it will be a blast. I mean, we've had so much fun watching everything you've done down there and built.
Thank you.
So it would be a pleasure to come down there. We are going to take a break for a word from our sponsor, Knopf. Katie will be back at the end of the show for the speed round, and we will be right back with Chef Preeti Mistry. Imagine the culinary world without the influence of Julia Child, Marcella Hazan, Edna Lewis, Maher Joffrey, Lydia Bastianich, and Judith Jones. It's impossible. We have the iconic publishing house Knopf to thank for bringing the writings and the recipes of these women to life. Knopf's great tradition of supporting new voices continues today with Smitten Kitchen's Deb Perlman, Sweet Bitter's Stephanie Danler, and Butter Baked Good's Rosie Dakin. Check out Knopf's great collection of fiction, nonfiction, and cookbooks at your favorite bookstore. Keep reading and keep cooking with Knopf. Chef Preeti Mistry opened her restaurant Juhu Beach Club in Oakland in 2013. Her inspiration? The Indian street food she recalled from childhood trips to Mumbai. But Preeti was looking to reinvent Indian food and present her own modern take on the cuisine. The result is such yummy fare as Desi Jack's sweet and salty popcorn, masala fries, papadums and pickles, and a pulled pork slider with vindaloo barbecue sauce and cilantro yogurt slaw. I just named all my favorite things, Preeti. Now that we're nice and hungry, let's welcome Preeti to Radio Cherry Bomb.
Hi.
Hey. It's so nice to finally have actually both of you.
I'm so glad to be here.
We've known you both for a while now, and it's your first time on the show. So welcome, and welcome to the East Coast and to New York.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
It is our pleasure. So let's jump right into it. Tell us more about the food you make at Juhu Beach Club and why.
You know, the food has really evolved, I would say, over the last 3 years and actually 5 years, because we actually started as a pop-up in a liquor store in San Francisco, and that was in 2011. So what a ride.
And that was a thing back then.
Yeah. It was really a thing. It was,
the thing being doing pop-ups in sort of unexpected places.
Yeah. And sort of, it was kind of a burgeoning thing. Now you have like, you know, to some celebrity chef at Macy's pop-up and it's like, okay, I don't really understand where we've come with this board pop-up. But, it was literally in the front of a liquor store. I lived across the street and I asked the guy if I could use the space during the day. And, we had like 3 Indian sandwiches, a handmade samosa and a mango lassi.
So why Indian food?
Well, I'm of Indian heritage. I cooked European California cuisine for 10 plus years, but I always knew eventually I was going to cook Indian. Mm-hmm. I think it was really important to me when I was, you know, young and sort of realizing I wanted to cook that I wanted to get like a, you know, professional education and not just jump in as a home cook. So that was important for me to, you know, I did go to culinary school, but I didn't have a graduate degree already. So,
but you were
I needed more schooling.
You were a late bloomer though, right?
You
didn't really realize.
I was 25.
when you went to culinary school?
Yeah. So, you know, I was in culinary school, there were various ages, but I think once I started interning, you know, I interned in the basement of Claridge's Hotel. And, you know, my boss was like 6 years younger than me, but he'd been at it for, you know, since he was like 14 years old. It was the European style. This was in London.
Yeah. How did you wind up in culinary school in London?
Well, I was born in London. And at the time that I was thinking about changing career, so I wanted to be a filmmaker. And I was working in like a nonprofit arts, film organization. My wife, had an opportunity with her job to move to Europe. And the, you know, it was like Copenhagen or London. And I was like, okay, well, I have British citizenship, so I could actually get a job. And also I'd speak English. So we decided to move to London, and it was like the perfect opportunity for me to sort of make that break from the film industry and the arts world into cooking.
Did a specialty emerge, or you were just sort of getting your feet wet in the beginning, learning everything?
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, I'm not like a whole animal butchery kind of person. I'm, you know, more into the sauces, spices, marinades. I think flavor profiles, and that is sort of the thing that sings to me. I think, you know, we're in London, so then all your friends in culinary school end up working at all these different restaurants. And, you know, I remember going to Vong with a friend of mine who's still a good friend of mine. He was working there, and, you know, it's always like, yeah, let's go on your night off, and we get the hookup at the fancy restaurant. You know, and there were so many sauces on that menu that I was just blown away by. Just, like, how do these ingredients even go together? It just really inspired me to kind of go back and, you know, and then you were talking about like braising and things like that. I think that those are the kinds of areas, like developing those kinds of deeper flavors, that really speak to my cooking.
So you and Anne eventually moved back. Mm-hmm. When did you two decide you wanted to open a restaurant together?
You know, I don't think we ever decided we wanted to open a restaurant together. It all just kind of happened. We actually had a catering business, around 2004 to 2006, we did pretty well considering we were nobody and it was catering. We, you know, we actually had a spread in 7x7 magazine because, you know, we were doing something interesting. It wasn't just, you know, the caterer who's like, I do everything for everyone. We were like modern Indian catering. And so we, you know, we made a bit of a splash, but then Anne would said, after 2 years, I'm sick of lugging dirty dishes at 1 o'clock in the morning. And I used to make a lot of money working in an office and talking on the phone, and going to meetings. And I was like, okay, I get it. And she really didn't want anything else to do with this industry. That was 2006.
Is that when you went to Google?
I went to the De Jong first. So I started as the catering chef at the De Jong Museum, and the Legion of Honor. They're, combined. And within about 7 months, my boss, who was the catering director, the two of us kind of staged a semi-hostile takeover and basically told her boss that, these guys who are running the two cafes and these two museums, that we didn't need them, that I could be the executive chef of the whole operation and she could be the general manager and we could get rid of all this overhead.
That's a risky move. You weren't worried it would backfire? You
no.
You haven't watched The Sopranos?
We just needed them to get out of our way. Quite honestly.
So then what came next?
We were there for about 2.5-3 years. Bon Appetit is the management company. You know, they do a lot of food service for a lot of folks.
They did the Yahoo cafeteria.
Yahoo. Mm-hmm. So they're also at Google. So we lost the account at the museums. It was a political thing. It had nothing to do with our performance. Mainly obvious because we didn't all get fired. And that's how I ended up at Google. So
when I worked for Yahoo, I would go out to Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. I worked in the New York office, but I would go out to Silicon Valley every now and then. And the food operation blew my mind. Four different cafeterias,
yeah.
Full size, different food at each. There was Asian food at one, American food at another. Then we had a giant cafeteria with beautiful Indian food, mm-hmm. Salads, smoothies, burgers. Like I could not believe what I was seeing. It was crazy. And the food was really good.
Yeah.
Was Google like that?
I mean, I ran the largest cafeteria, the original cafeteria at Google, Charlie's, which serves about 3,000 people a day, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. We had a Mediterranean pizza station. We had a sushi station. We had a deli. We had a grill. We had a salad bar. We had an Indian station with a tandoor. We had a Chinese station with a wok, pastry program. And we ran all of the catering for the whole campus out of that kitchen.
Tech employees are so spoiled.
Yes, they are.
There's food everywhere.
Yes, they are.
So not only do you have these cafeterias, but then you have like food stations,
yeah,
snack stations.
Micro kitchens,
micro,
we call them.
That's right. The micro kitchens everywhere with every power bar, little hummusy thing.
And they're so hungry for everything. It's kind of amazing. Like we used to make a joke because everything's free at Google that if it's not like nailed down, they believe it's theirs to take. Like, you know, we'd do a catering thing where there'd be fancy cheeses and fruits and stuff. And sometimes there'd be leftovers. And we like just put it in the micro kitchen and we would just like watch from like 10 feet away to see how quickly like these little heads would pop up out of the cubicles. Like, I smell fancy cheese. Like there's something. it was impressive.
So let's jump to Juhu. Uh-huh. So you do your pop-up, you decide I'm doing a real restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
So you pick a space in a strip mall, mm-hmm, across from a pawnbroker,
mm-hmm,
in Oakland.
And a check cashing place.
And a check cashing place. Forgot about that. And Oakland. And mm-hmm, not a lot of restaurateurs were taking a gamble on Oakland at that point. You have Tanya Holland, mm-hmm, Dominica Rice, mm-hmm, you know, a handful of great women who have opened restaurants. Why Oakland?
Well, we had moved to Oakland in the meantime. What I was actually experiencing, I had a partner, that was not a relative, and we were going to open in San Francisco, long permitting process. And in that time period when I was dealing with the city of San Francisco and also realizing I didn't want to be in business with this person, I just kept thinking, oh, damn, we should have the restaurant here. There's so much happening. I mean, there was just this energy. You know, it reminded me of the Mission in San Francisco in the late 90s. There was just this really intense, wonderful energy that, you know, has been slowly being sucked out of San Francisco. And so, you know, when things fell through in San Francisco, I actually saw it was a gift because I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And we originally looked in Uptown. But then we found this space that was literally, I mean, it's like a 4-minute bike ride from my house.
That's so sweet.
Yeah, it's kind of an amazing thing. One of the things that hit me soon after we opened was the fact that that is so rare in our world anymore, that you can be being a small business owner that owns a restaurant in their own neighborhood. That, you know, I walk out my front, sometimes I'm not that happy about it, but, you know, cause the neighbors, I walk out my front door and they're like, I went to the restaurant last weekend, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, okay, oh, thanks for your feedback.
Yeah. Same for Katie, same for me. Our restaurants are all in our neighborhoods,
yeah,
and you kind of become the mayor, whether you want to or not.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, and my wife was saying that today, she's like, we have to move. We can't go anywhere. Everybody knows us.
Well, the good news is you're opening a new place.
Uh-huh.
So tell us about the new place.
Navi Kitchen. We're pretty excited about it. Navi means in Hindi means new. So it's a new spot, new kitchen. It's going to be a little bit more casual. So Juhu is not fine dining, but it's, you know, it's full service, full bar. This is going to be beer and wine. It was originally a cafe. And so the concept is this sort of all-day space that has, a little bit of everything for everyone at any time of day. So we're going to have a chai bar, which I'm really excited about. So at the restaurant, we just do very, traditional chai, which means that it has the sugar in it, has milk in it. Here, we're going to have that, but we're also going to have DIY chai. So you can get whatever sort of dairy product or none, whatever sweetener you want. And then we'll probably have a few other things that we'll throw in, some cardamom syrup and, you know, some cinnamon or rose water, et cetera.
What's the projected opening date?
We're looking at spring, hopefully February.
Okay.
February 1st is our big push. We'll see if we can get there. A couple things I'm really excited about. The concept is a counter service place. So, I love pizza. So we're going to do Indian pizza, but
cool,
a little different than most of the Indian pizza that people are used to. I think most of the Indian pizza you see, it's very your sort of like American style, sort of big fluffy crust loaded with toppings. So my inspiration will be more of the Neapolitan style pizza. We're going to use, I think Indian pizza is a brilliant thing. It's like naan dough is so similar to pizza dough. So we're going to use yogurt and ghee in the dough instead of olive oil. But we'll probably still use like a 00 flour. And the ingredients will all be sort of, you know, same as JBC, very like farmer's market, whatever's looking good, and, you know, very just like subtle Indian accents to things. And then this rotisserie chicken that we're going to do in the evenings with a burnt masala brine, which is this concept I sort of came up with and tried, and it's delicious. But the idea was sort of, you know, the flavor that you get from a tandoor, but in a rotisserie chicken. And so I took a spice blend that I came up with and just toasted it a little longer than I felt comfortable with. And use that in the brine. And then we also make a compound butter that we brush on it with the masala. And it's fantastic.
Sounds so good. So, Preeti, I have to say, one of the things I've always admired about you is you are not afraid to be outspoken. And we were talking about this a little bit outside.
Uh-huh.
It's a tough climate right now.
Mm.
You know, you want to defend what you believe in, but it's there's so much attacking that's going on. But
mm-hmm.
but you've been brave from day one about whether it's authenticity, identity, you name it. Where does that come from in you?
You know, I mean, I think that one thing that sticks with me is I don't generally have as much opportunity to hide. So I might as well just be who I am. You know, John Birdsall wrote this piece recently. I can't remember the name of it, I think, but it was about like queer chefs. And one of the things that he said was that there were all these chefs maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when he tried to do a story like this, and people wouldn't talk to him, even though he knew that most of these chefs were out in their community and at large. And, you know, one of the things I pointed out to him was most of them were white. Most of them were also cisgendered. There's a certain segment of the population, if all of a sudden they're on the Food Network, that doesn't really connect with the gaydar. And so they can kind of hide in that, and that's really a safe place to not lose endorsements or what have you. I don't really have that liberty, which, you know, also gives me the opportunity to not have to constantly come out to people. It's pretty obvious. But for me, I guess there's not really a lot of places to hide. So to me, it just feels like the best thing to do is just be who I am, because I think that gets me a lot farther in the world than trying to fit into what people want me to be.
Were you like that as a child?
Yeah.
You were the youngest of three girls, right?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. I only got in one physical fight as a kid, and I kicked his butt. And it was this kid who, it was like the seventh or eighth grade, and I was not cool. Like, high school, I got a little cooler. But in junior high, I was totally like this nerdy little girl. And this kid would just every single day pick on the Jewish kid about something, this girl making lewd comments. And one day in the morning, he said something to me about, you know, some stupid thing, Hindu something or other. And I just like threw my books down and just started pushing him and punching him. And, you know, I didn't know where it came from. It just out of nowhere. And it's not like I went in that morning thinking I'm going to kick this kid's butt. And then all of a sudden I realized what I was doing and that I could get in a lot of trouble. And I stopped and I just looked at him and I said, "You better not say anything to anybody else or I'm going to kick your ass." And that was, and I sat down.
Did they call your mother?
They did. They did. And it was hilarious because, of course, they said, you know, your daughter got in a fight. And my mother was like, "Oh, my God, is she hurt?" And the vice principal said, "Well, she actually started it." I mean, the physical part of it, which was hilarious. And I remember my dad was on call. My dad's a doctor. And he came home the next morning and he just poked his head in my room. And he looked at me and he said, "I heard you got in a fight." And I said, "Yeah." And he just said, "Good." And he kept walking.
I love it. And you're still fighting.
Yep.
In a good way. In a good way. So we are going to stop here. It's time for the speed round. We're trying something new this time. Katie, you can pull your chair up to your mic. We're going to have the two guests do the speed round together. Let's see how it goes. Are you ready?
All right. Yeah.
Okay.
I promise not to interrupt you.
So the idea here is... short, quick answers, but you can explain a little bit. So, okay, we'll start with Preeti. Coffee or tea?
Coffee.
Katie?
Coffee.
How do you take it?
Milk, no sugar.
Milk, cream, usually a latte, steamed milk.
I feel like chefs all say, all of you have answered coffee with some milk.
I was going to say, actually, except for chai. I do have my chai sometimes.
I would say it's because you're running out the door, and for me, like maybe on no breakfast, and like black coffee on an empty stomach. Mm. Like I just need like a little bit of cream. You can skip breakfast, move on, eat later.
Sweet or salty?
Salty.
Sweet.
What's in your fridge?
Pickles, leftover pizza, wine.
Cheese, milk.
You have a child at home, so you...
Broccoli. For my child.
That sounds so exciting.
Totally milk.
Preeti, what kitchen tool do you use the most at home?
Microplane zester.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. A saute pan? My cast iron skillet.
If you were trapped on a desert island with one food celebrity, who would it be?
Oh my gosh, that's such a hard
Preeti's
question.
Looking like she'd rather kill herself than have to pick one. Or have to be trapped with
one. I'm overwhelmed.
First person who comes to mind. You can't pass.
Barbara Lynch. I think she's super scrappy.
Okay.
I was asked to interrupt.
No, that's fine. You're buying me time. Is what you're doing. You're buying me time right now.
All right, Preeti, you still have to answer
I still have
question.
To answer it. I've only met her once for a minute, but April Bloomfield.
Oh, I bet April would be fun.
That would be good.
Absolutely.
She seems like fun.
Okay, good answer. What are you reading right now?
Other than recipes that I have to tweak for my book. Bright Lines, I read a book recently. I can't remember the author's name.
What's it about?
It's about these young Muslim women in Brooklyn. One of them is possibly queer. And then also their father and sort of their struggles in life. This was like, I think it takes place in the 90s.
Katie?
It's a Malcolm Gladwell book. I think it's Outliers is the title, but mm-hmm. it's anyway, really interesting. It's about success and certain people who become super successful. And then like, he like slowly debunks everything that you think about like innate ability and stuff like that. So it's really interesting. I'm really enjoying it.
I can see you being a Malcolm Gladwell fan.
Yeah. Yeah.
He has a great new podcast, by the way, if you haven't listened to it yet. Where would you like to travel to next?
Vietnam.
Yeah, that's a good one. I'm like, but you know why? Because I want to travel everywhere.
Right.
I'd like to go to India. I have never been. So, yeah, India.
I was going to say India because there's just so much of it I still have not seen. But, you know, I also recently, it was actually Parts Unknown, the recent one, I was like, why have we still not been here? We need to go to Vietnam.
Yeah. Too many places to travel. That's tough. Everywhere.
It's tough to be a chef and have to answer that question.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
you want to eat everywhere. Everything.
And you go back to Spain once a year, right?
We do. Yeah. I do want to travel to other parts of Spain. Like there's been a few areas I've visited, but there are definitely like holes in things I haven't done yet in Spain too. Mm-hmm.
Well, sadly, that is it for today's show. It's been so great having you two on the show. Again, you are on our first Jubilee conference. We've followed your careers and are just so excited and proud of what you've built and accomplished. And thank you for being here today. It was a pleasure speaking with you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, as always, to our engineer, Dave Tadashore, and much love to Knopf for supporting this season of Radio Cherry Bomb and for publishing such beautiful books. Don't forget to support Heritage Radio, the not-for-profit home of Radio Cherry Bomb. To make a donation, visit heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
Food writer and cookbook editor. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. To subscribe and learn more, visit cherrybomb.com. You know who I think is the bomb? Diana Lovett. She's the founder of Cise, an ethically responsible cocoa company that gets their beans from an organic, fair trade cooperative in the Dominican Republic. Cise's baking mixes, hot cocoa, and super thin brownies are made with real ingredients and sourced with care. Plus, they're really delicious.